Words we live by.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By, a transcribed program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present another in this series of informal and unrehearsed discussions of selected passages from the Bible. And now we take pleasure in introducing our moderator, Professor Judah Golden of the University of Iowa. Professor Golden.
At each of these sessions of The Words We Live By, as we carry on, we try to capture something of the permanent relevance of the basic questions which the Bible asks, in a number of passages. In the studio today are Dr. Saul Ginsberg of the Psychiatry Department of Columbia University, Professor Abraham Halkin of the City College, and our guest, the well-known editor of the Saturday Review of Literature, Mr. Norman Cousins. The question for today's discussion is part of the dramatic story in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel. When the people ask the prophet Samuel, that is, to establish a monarchy. Here's part of the story just to get started as our announcer, Bill Malcolm, reads it.
Then all the elders of Israel gathered and came to Samuel and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel, and the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people, for they have not rejected thee but me, that I should not be king over them. Howbeit, earnestly forewarn them, and declare unto them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people. But the people refused to hearken, and they said, Nay, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations.
Thank you very much, Bill Malcolm. What is it, Dr. Ginsberg?
I think it would be very helpful if, at the beginning, we could have some idea about the situation which led the people to demand a monarchy in the first place.
Mr. Cousins?
Well, as a lay participant on this program, I'd like to second the motion. I think we ought to have more about the historical framework of this particular chapter.
All right, Dr. Halkin, you take it.
Well, I suppose it's the political situation of the time that accounts for their request. It happened, I suppose, sometime between 1050 and 1000 before the Common Era. And it was a time when the Philistines, who had just recently arrived into Palestine, began to make their push eastward. And they certainly scored a good many successes at the beginning of their invasion, so that the existence of the State of Israel was really in danger at the time.
And why? I'm sorry, Dr. Halkin.
This is probably what made them ask for a king.
Why should the Philistines have been more of a threat to them than some of the previous peoples?
Well, I suppose the reason is that the Philistines came in as a united group. They were driven out of their own land, were seeking a home for themselves, and landed on the seashore of Palestine and simply decided to get the land.
Dr. Ginsberg.
This discussion and explanation highlights for me something that each passage impresses on me so much, and that is the remarkable aptness of these passages and their fitness for discussion in a purely contemporary sense.
Well, what do you find here, for example?
Well, we find here a threatened people demanding a strong leader. Certainly, we have abundant examples of that in contemporary and recent past history, that whenever the people are threatened, they must have a leader in whom they can have faith and in whose strength they really believe.
But what was the matter with Samuel? Wasn't he serving as a leader? Mr. Cousins.
Well, I'd like to go back just a moment because I think that Doc Ginsberg brought up a very important point for our own times. It seems, in reading this particular section, that the people had what you might call crisis fatigue, something that's happening today when the individual feels himself separated from his own times. When he has a feeling of helplessness, when he feels he's lost command of his destiny. At that particular point, there's always the demand for a leader, someone who can tell me what to do. And it seems that the people at this particular time had this crisis fatigue, and they wanted to be told what to do, which poses the next question. What should they do? What type of leadership should they have?
Well, I can't quite follow, though I agree that what we have registered here is some kind of fatigue, or crisis fatigue, as you put it very well. What was the matter with Samuel? He was acting as a leader, certainly, all this time. They had been getting along for quite a long time with judges, and granted that the Philistines were more of a threat than some of the other nations, What is it that they found inadequate in the case of Samuel?
Well, the Bible answers that. It isn't Samuel who was ruler at the time. It was his sons.
The judges.
The Bible tells us that his sons did not walk in his path and that they were not the pure leaders he had been. And this is what caused them to look for a change.
Dr. Ginsburg.
That's a commonplace that when the people begin to lose faith, rightly or wrongly, they naturally must look for a new leader in whom they can regain that faith. And whether Samuel's son's derelictions were so severe as to really justify the distrust of the people or not, the fact is that they felt that his sons were no longer leaders whom they could trust. And in their extremity, they quested for a type of leadership which would give them the proximity of sharing the leadership of the people around them. They wanted a king. They wanted to be like other people. Of course, we all of us feel more secure when we're like other people.
Well, do you think that that was at the heart of the matter, in other words, their desire to be like other people, which made them turn away from Samuel from Samuel's sons as possible successors?
No, I would rather look on that as effect than as cause. I think they were tired, as Mr. Cousin said, they were fatigued. They had lost faith in their leaders. They were being licked in a war. They saw great consequences ahead. And they wanted leaders in whom they could regain their confidence. They looked about, and apparently they felt that a king, a strong symbol, a strong leader, would serve their purposes, and that's what they requested.
Yes, you have the atmosphere in which the totalitarian state, historically speaking, and this is a classical case, in which the totalitarian state comes to power. The people are tired, they want to be told what to do, they're facing a crisis, they know they're unequal to it, and they're willing to make a sacrifice for the totalitarian state.
Well, it's quite clear to see in the case of a totalitarian state in our own times, but here the issue is between a state at the head of which God is the ruler, and God, I imagine, ought to make the state to be as successful and as perfect as is possible, and the demand for a human king.
Of course, this particular theocracy had certain aspects of totalitarianism in it, too, I think you'll agree.
Well, why do you say that?
As we read this, the absolute authority over the individual, I think, would define the basis of a totalitarian state. I don't think there's much question that absolute authority was possessed. The fact that you could say, or one could say at the time, that this is the voice of God that commands me and that therefore I command you, doesn't make it any less a totalitarian state. I think we have to bear in mind that God's voice was not presented directly to the people, but was presented to them through a filter. In this case, Samuel.
Well, you know, some of the earliest commentators, by the way, on the Bible, the rabbis in the Talmud and in the Midrash, these compilations where we get the early commentaries on Scripture, I think were sensitive to what was involved here. For example, they have a long homily in connection with some of these passages where they point out that God said, under my sovereignty, you would have been much better off than under the sovereignty of a king. Before we try to oppose, let's say, the sovereignty of God to the sovereignty of the king, I think it's very wise to look at what Scripture itself had to say about the monarchy. Now, there's always a danger, needless to say, that we will apply to an ancient time terms from our own experience when the ancient times, of course, didn't anticipate those experiences.
Although when you're dealing with God, Professor, I'm sure you realize you're dealing with someone who perhaps can go beyond his own time. That was the point I had.
I'm pretty sure that God will take care of time altogether on his own, and he doesn't need either professors or anybody else for his support. But here's what I'm driving at. I think if you look at the passage again, and you see the way in which the monarchy is described, you find that our application of the term totalitarian wouldn't altogether be bad. You remember when Samuel tells the people what the nature of the monarchy is going to be, he says, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them unto him for his chariots and to be his horsemen, and they shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint them unto him for captains of thousands and for captains of fifties, and to plow his ground and reap his harvest and make him instruments of war and the instruments of chariots. And he will take your daughters to be perfumers and to be cooks and to be bakers. He will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards, and he will take your men servants and your maid servants, and so it goes.
Yeah, that's pretty totalitarian, I should say.
But I personally think that this is really more of a threat, an attempt to discourage the people from asking for a king than a description of reality. So far as I know, in the history of the first monarchy, there's no king who went to such extremes in his rule over the people.
Psychologically, this has two very interesting aspects, as far as I can see. In the first instance, that despite all the threat of what terrible things are going to happen, the people's conviction that they need a king, that they need a strong ruler, simply transcends all the things that are threatening them. They simply put those aside, which modern people we know are doing all the time. We warn them and they don't heed our warning because they have a conviction born of their own emotional needs, which simply go beyond the warning. The second thing that I think is illustrated here is that what they needed was a leader whom they could see, who had corporeal, bodily existence, that they had lost faith in God since they were distracted and weary and were threatened. People who are threatened have to have something which they can cling, either by way of symbol or by way of a real body of a leader.
Mr. Cousins.
Well, do you think, Dr. Ginsburg, that they lost faith in God, and this comes back to an earlier point I made, do you think that they lost faith in God because they didn't believe in God or because they lost faith in the interpretation of God, the conception of God, the projection of God by such men as leaders as Samuel, by such men as Samuel's sons? In other words, it's the inadequacy of the interpreters rather than of God himself.
Well, I think that's right. It's always God as interpreted by his leaders. When the great prophets were in existence and the people had faith in the prophets, their faith in God was strengthened by that.
I believe that the whole question of the existence of faith in God or the loss of faith in God is really irrelevant. I can't picture to myself that in those days it would be possible to think of a group that had lost its faith in God. To me, it seems that...
Well, could say confidence, then, instead of faith.
Well, but what I really want to say is this, that God didn't reveal himself every day. They, too, had a human leader. And it was a human leader who was weaker than the situation which he had to meet, and for this reason, they simply asked for a change.
Well, not only did he not reveal himself, but the political leaders themselves maintain almost a monopoly in their pipeline to the deity.
Well, I don't know that you find that necessarily in Scripture, that the political leaders are the ones who insist that they have, as you say, a pipeline to the deity.
Political matters.
I don't even know whether that's true in political matters.
I think Samuel can't even be called a political leader. Samuel is described in the Bible as a prophet, and the successes he scores in the military field are the result of God's direct aid to him. He's not really what we would call a political leader.
Well, I'm sure that Samuel himself would agree with that. Nevertheless, he was the head of state, and as such, I believe he was a political leader, or at least qualifies in a historical sense, if not the theological sense.
Well, I think we can go on for some time arguing whether Samuel really was a political leader, though didn't call himself that, or not. I think it would be wise, however, to take up a challenge which Mr. Halkin brought up just a few minutes ago, in which I think it would be in place to meet here. He says that this description that we have here of the monarchy is mostly a threat, and that he cannot think of the historical situation throughout the period of the First Commonwealth, the First Temple, when the monarchy ever did become as bad as that. I don't know that the monarchy ever did become literally as bad as the passage here would make it out to be, but isn't the passage intended essentially to point out what are the potentialities of a monarchy?
Yes, but then you see a question rises which really troubled me as I reread this chapter. What essentially is the difference between the theocracy that God seems to hold so dear and the monarchy which the people are asking for? After all, God didn't appear as a daily judge or as a daily ruler. It was still a rule represented by priests or the prophet, human beings at all times. And who knows but that the picture of the monarchy they got is really one of experience of what they had in their own day. Why is he so upset about their demand? What's the change?
And why is God so peeved?
Yes.
What's bothering him, Dr. Ginsburg?
I don't have any idea about that, but one thing I'm impressed by in all this discussion is that we lay too much emphasis on what these people think and not enough emphasis on what they feel. People in ancient times, the way people nowadays make their decisions in terms of what they feel, and very little indeed in terms of truly what they think. And so when you offer them this whole body of terrible things that are going to happen to them, they make very little impress on the people.
No, but I'm leaving the people to you, Dr. Ginsburg. I'm really interested here in Samuel and in God. That they asked for the monarchy is understandable. What I can't quite understand is why God speaks in terms of their rejecting him, why Samuel feels that they rejected him. What's all this about?
I can't tell from the way Mr. Cousins is grinning whether he wants to add something by way of support of you, Mr. Halkin, or he really intends to tear into you.
No, we're not on a TV program. I'm glad you're giving this a play-by-play description. But as Mr. Halkin spoke, I agreed with him. You see, I was puzzled, too, when Dr. Ginsburg spoke about this concept of God, and a rather limited concept of God it was, too, I think, that emerges, because we're now describing God as a psychologist, someone who is not above threatening people with certain things, someone who uses strategy, and poor strategy at that. I don't think you persuade people by threatening them, as the people are threatened here. And throughout the entire section, as a matter of fact, we do get a rather temperamental God, and I'm just wondering whether this concept of God actually advances the idea of the deity as we should like it to be.
I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't want to come now to the defense of God, because that would be about the greatest slap in the face of God, if you'll forgive the expression. It could be.
Gosh, we're getting heretical, aren't we?
Well, I hope we are getting heretical to the sense of...
See, I'm a layman. I can
oh,
do
yeah,
this,
you can all afford it.
I'm among...
I don't think it's either a matter of heresy or orthodoxy that's involved. I think it's essentially a matter of understanding the nature of the story. Now, when Mr. Halkin says, what was there instead of the monarchy? The implication is that there would be no difference if there were a theocracy. And we might even say that if priests are in control, things are no better than when kings are in control. I think Scripture itself would endorse that, because when Scripture would speak of God being sovereign, it would have in mind the ideal situation where God himself would be revealing the truth, would be revealing what is right. And obviously, if the right is what one lives up to, you would have a better situation than the situation with which all of us is unfortunately too familiar, where human beings set themselves
well,
up as absolute
the theory,
authority.
Mr. Golden, I think we ought to turn to the facts. What we have in the part of history which is recorded in the Bible is this: a world which is run pretty much as ours is, except for the difference in time and all that time brings about, and a God who keeps on demanding justice and righteousness and so on.
Well, isn't that significant?
Yes, but it seems to me that he's much more effective when he does it through prophets who are in the opposition to a king or to a ruler than in a case where his own men, so to speak, are the rulers of the state, and they represent supposedly what he wants, and then there is no voice even for protest or for reproach.
Ah, but you see, the prophets are his men, and that's, I think, a very significant thing. So long as we have the opportunity to hear the voice of the prophets, then, at least according to the biblical account, there is also the opportunity for seeing justice prevail in the world. You say, for instance, what kind of improvement would there have been over a monarchy? Well, consider a king like Ahab. Here was actually a monarch in Israel. He was prepared to murder and also to inherit. You remember that very dramatic passage with Elijah. There we can see what happens when a monarchy is established.
Good, but we had an Elijah who came up and asked him, have you murdered and now also inherit? Whereas in this instance, we have the two sons of Samuel, whom the Bible itself describes as children who do not follow in their father's path. Nobody rebukes them. There is no prophet to rise and tell them that they are doing wrong.
Well, what was the matter with Samuel? Why didn't he tell them?
I don't know. All I know is that he got angry when the people came and asked him for a king.
The thing that bothers me deeply is the lack of the art of persuasion in this. I mean, God will drop great stones on people and kill 50,000 of them at one time. The people will be saddened with the slaughter, and God will threaten. But we haven't enough of the persuasion. The issue of right and wrong in terms of morality, it's not enough to demand justice. It's not enough to threaten. The issue must be defined, and the moral issues must be defined.
I think on the very...
This is what I miss.
I think on the very contrary, if you'll forgive me, Mr. Cousins, at least in this particular chapter, what you do see is an attempt at persuasion, which I think it is very difficult for us to imitate. God, apparently, according to this story, objects to the monarchy. Nevertheless, what does he do? He finally yields, doesn't he? He says to Samuel, hearken to the people, let them go ahead and establish the monarchy, right? But what does he do before that? He feels that the monarchy is wrong, and he goes to the trouble to describe to the people, to anticipate for them. This is the possibility to which life may be reduced if you establish a monarchy. What else was he to do? He might have said, for example, no monarchy simply because I say there is not to be any king.
But this reluctant concession of
well,
God...
Well, still,
the threat is only
hypothetical. I mean, this is merely an interpretation we are placing on it. It could also be interpreted as prophecy in addition to threat.
Dr. Ginsburg.
How do people believe in a God? That really isn't just an abstraction. They believe in a God because they believe in the person who has introduced in their life in the very earliest of their years the concept of God and what God stands for. And when they lose faith in the person who represents God to them, they lose faith to that extent in God's omnipotence and omniscience to lead them out of their difficulty.
But aren't you speaking a little too ideally, Dr. Ginsburg? Personally, it seems to me that the people believe in a God, or at least those people believe in a God, who made their life prosperous and who made their political career successful.
But God is an ideal as far as I'm concerned.
I know, but it's an ideal.
Speak too ideally about God.
Yes, but
God.
An ideal who's got to be made concrete in reality and the kind of reality they like.
And through a leader.
And certainly to the people themselves, Dr. Ginsburg, he was a reality. He was not simply a projection out of their mentality.
Well, I hope Dr. Ginsburg holds his ground on this, because the concept of God is important, especially when it's a limited concept. And the concept of God in this case was of a temperamental God, a God who is not above being vengeful, a God who at times could lose his temper, a God who, as a matter of fact, had very little of a sense of history, because we discover that God has omitted in this case the most important thing of all from our point of view. God knew nothing about democracy. And the choice presented to the people here was the theocracy or the monarchy. Now, if this were not a limited concept of God, perhaps they might have heard the voice of God and talk about democracy, talk about popular rule, talk about widespread education, raising questions which are much too contemporaneous, because I conceive of God as someone who can transcend his own time and who's not limited to the circumstances which may or may not have made democracy possible at that particular moment.
I don't know that we're being fair particularly to this passage. What is it that we expect? Do we expect to find in this passage the idiom, the exact idiom of our own time? I think essentially what we're doing when we look at this passage is to see what underlies it. That the word democracy may not be used doesn't prove one thing one way or the other. I'm pretty sure that the narrator...
If you have the substance of democracy, I would agree, but there's no way here
there's no way.
Of democracy.
There is no way of doing that. Now, I think there is a significant substance. If you look at the story again, you find two things. You have, in addition to others, but you have, first of all, an objection to an institution, which is here called the monarchy, because that institution is one which can exercise total control over you. I think that passage is one which we ought not overlook, because, after all, it is a description of what the monarchy is supposed to be. Anything, any institution which can exercise total control over society, where your sons are taken away, where your food is taken away in order to feed the household of the king, where you will have no freedom in order to express yourself, anything like that, I think, is justifiably called totalitarian. I don't mean that Nazism or fascism or totalitarianism in our immediate application is what is in the mind of the narrator. Now, if there is objection to that, evidently there is an approval. There is an implicit approval of a system where the individual would have freedom. You have a second objection, it seems to me, in the story, which is brought out in a phrase that recurs. The phrase, for example, "Nay, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like unto the nations." The people are asking for what? They want to become like everybody else. They seem to be crying for an indiscriminate leveling. They want to be just like everybody else and not assume any unique kind of responsibility. Now, this is objected to in the story, and I don't know why that should be overlooked necessarily. Dr. Ginsburg.
Well, I think there are two defects in that reasoning. First place, the indiscriminate leveling isn't quite a objective estimate of what they're looking for. When they say they want to be like other people, they're expressing the most human of desires. There's nobody who's more uncomfortable and more threatened and frightened than a member of an outgroup of any kind, a member of a group that's different. And what they're asking is they want to have a king like other people have a king.
Dr. Ginsburg, nobody denies that the people are asking that because it's the most human thing in the world to want to be like everybody else. The question I think that the chapter poses for us is the desire of the people a desire which would be an ideal desire to have?
And this is the question that we faced in this country 170 years ago, that the Athenians had to face themselves, described so vividly, if not perhaps so accurately, in Aristotle. What type of government is best? And I think that that is the essence of what we have here. And that is why I come back to my earlier point. I'd like to say that I'm not trying to second-guess the deity. All I'm trying to say is that it's notoriously poor strategy in attempting to persuade people to talk about punishments if they do the wrong thing, instead of talking about the importance of doing the right thing as an end in itself.
Well, but it certainly carries more weight when you speak to people this way than
talking about
you
strategy.
Speak to them in terms of justice and of abstract ideals.
But apparently not. The people were described as terrible monarchy which would come to pass and all the horrible things which would happen to them, and they insisted they wanted a monarchy because they wanted to be like other people.
Well, but now I'll fall back to what you said earlier in the discussion today, that they were more guided by their emotional needs than by mental considerations of what they were getting in the...
Well, sure. I suppose, too, that the perception of God is somewhat above strategy.
Well, I think, Mr. Cousins, you're sort of hopping on God, if I may say, a little more than...
No, just this limited conception of God. You see, I think God is being cut down to the size of people who have an inadequate conception of it.
But you can't open up the Bible at any one page without finding God there. And if we people think in a different frame of reference, it's because our age has changed. They always thought in terms of a world with God in it and spoke in terms of a world with God in it. And as far as God not promoting a republic or a democracy, I imagine God always speaks in the voice of the time rather than in the voice of 5,000 years hence.
I would agree with that. It's because I agree with it that I made the point that it was this limited concept of God that limited the aspirations of the people themselves.
If we call it limiting the aspirations of the people to protest against their desire to have a totalitarian form, let's for the moment grant what the argument itself says. Then I suppose it would be a limitation. But then, gentlemen, I'd like to remind you that there were voices, for example, in the 30s, which cried out to the German people saying that your desire in the midst of your crisis fatigue to have a great leader whom you will worship virtually, who will take of your sons and of your daughters and of your vineyards and of your fields, and he will control everything in your life, that desire is also a legitimate desire. That the cry of the people, we want to be like everybody else, and if there is any particular responsibility which we may have to share, is a cry which is somewhat painful, then we had better begin to accustom ourselves to a mediocrity which would be frightening.
Well, I think that only illustrates a very basic truth, that it's much harder to persuade people than one ordinarily thinks, and that the mere listing of all the dangers and hardships that are ahead will not transcend necessarily by any means their deep emotional needs.
I think that is true. I think we have to keep in mind, in every passage which we read in Scripture, I think we have to keep in mind one thing. Scripture recognizes what the human being wants. Scripture recognizes the naturalness of his wanting certain things, but all the time it keeps setting certain ideals. It keeps setting up demands that he transcend his mere impulses, let us say, or mere appetite. Here, what do we have? There is an objection to a monarchy, which is understandable in desire. There is objection also to the desire to be like everybody else, and that's all.
You have just heard another in the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By. Our moderator was Professor Judah Golden, and our panelists were Dr. Saul Ginsberg and Professor Abraham Halkin. Our special guest today was Mr. Norman Cousins, distinguished editor of the Saturday Review of Literature. Be with us again next week when we'll discuss the important question raised by the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy, what mean the testimonies and the statutes and the ordinances which the Lord our God hath commanded you? Comments from the listeners will be appreciated. Our guest next week will be Dr. Alice V. Kelleher, professor of education at the School of Education, New York University. Free time to present The Words We Live By is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America.